Hello and welcome to the Conduits podcast series on humanizing investment. Inspired by Gillian Tett's book, Anthrovision, this series will focus on inspiring the next generation of investors to recognize the value of responsible investing. I'm Asha Ladd, impact champion at The Conduit, and each episode I will be talking to a leading responsible investor in the institutional responsible investing space, getting to grips with each of their stories, understanding what led them towards a career in the space, and how they feel we can begin to humanize the finance industry. My guest today is Liesl Priska-Simmons. Liesl and her husband Ian co-founded Blue Haven Initiative, a single family office managing a diversified global investment portfolio. Blue Haven Initiative is considered the largest impact-focused family office in the US and is likely among the largest investment funds in the world dedicated solely to impact investing. Liesl oversees an impact investing portfolio structured to generate competitive financial returns and affect positive social and environmental change. The portfolio spans asset classes from public equities and fixed income holdings to private equity, direct investments, and philanthropic programs. Liesl also works closely with organizations that support and advance the field of impact investing. She was a co-founder of The Impact, a network of families committed to the conscientious stewardship of wealth. She is a former board member of Tonic, which provides tools for investors to evaluate impact investments, and on the board and investment committee of Impact Assets, an impact investing advisory service to impact investors and philanthropic organizations. Liesl is also co-founder of IDP Foundation, focused on improving learning outcomes for underserved children in developing countries. So I normally ask my guests on the show, you know, how they've made their money impactful. Pretty clear from your creation of Blue Haven Initiative, how you've done that and how you've committed all of your capital across different asset classes to do that. You know, which kind of raises the classic impact investing 101 question, how do you balance profit and purpose together? So how satisfied are you that this is possible in your current or your projected portfolio?
Sure. Well, great. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. So, you know, essentially, so Blue Haven is our single family office, and we decided several years ago that we wanted to really have impact across all of our investments in each asset class, kind of from start to finish. And here we are sort of 12 years later, and I'm pretty happy with the journey that we've been on. I mean, there's always a lot more to do, and there's always ways that we're learning and getting better and improving and sort of calling bullshit on this and trying to get better on that. But generally speaking, to answer your question, I think it is possible. There are enough really great businesses and investment strategies out there that both see a financial opportunity as well as solving some type of environmental or social issue. And that's not true of every investment, and there certainly are trade-offs in certain industries and in certain sectors for sure. And there are areas that I think businesses are not very good at solving problems. Actually, they mostly make a mess. But we have been able to, in pretty much each asset class we've been looking, found opportunities that we're happy about. And then when things have gone awry, it's mostly been because, you know, it was 2022 and everything went south, or it was more of kind of a general market condition as opposed to it was because we focused on environmental impact or focused on the social outcome of that particular investment.
Yeah. So it's and it's market risk adjusted returns, and you look at it by asset class as well. Is that
so? For so the way that we built the majority of the investment portfolio, so the vast majority of the family office is in, yes, kind of your traditional sort of diversified asset allocation, and you know, from public equity all the way through venture capital, and fairly global. I mean, I'm U.S.-based, so we've got a bit of a U.S. bias. That being said, we also have quite a deep history in emerging markets investing, particularly fintech in sub-Saharan Africa. So we've got, I'd say we're overweight to that as well. But it's a pretty the asset allocation doesn't look insane to a normal traditional banker. But what we have done is, yes, within each asset class and sub-asset class, looked for best-in-class impact managers that have a risk-adjusted return. And then with our philanthropic portfolio, we do grants and catalytic or concessionary investments. Because we think there really should be space for all of that. But we want to be clear about each investment's return targets and sort of how hard we're making it work.
Yeah, so I want to really get into the risk-adjusted and then the philanthropic piece as well. Can you share with us what the target overall return is for the portfolio and how you've thought about that as well? What does good look like to you in terms of returns and over what time period?
So the way that we modeled the asset allocation, it actually ends up looking a little bit like a foundation endowment or like a university endowment model. And so then the reason for that is because my husband and I give away a fair amount of money every year as well. And so our kind of cash flow needs actually kind of look like a private foundation's, even though we are not a foundation, we're a family office. But so, you know, we're a relatively young couple. We have high cash flow needs because of the philanthropy, fairly risk tolerant, kind of we put all those inputs in. And so we end up with return targets sort of looking for like 8 to 11% returns, I'd say. Net of fees. And then we give away about 4 to 5% every year. And so that's kind of what we're looking for, blended across asset classes. But then, of course, we kind of have the same, you know, same benchmark return targets that anybody else would input.
Yeah, risk adjusted, get a return, but then you determine what to do with that cash flow yield that you're making, essentially.
Yeah.
And we all in impact.
Right.
Pretty incredible.
So, but the thing is that it's not as it actually, you know, when we started 12 years ago, I would say the universe of managers that had track record in this was certainly smaller than it is today. But we kind of started from the premise of every investment that anyone has ever made has had an impact, not just starting in 2007 when everybody decided to call it impact investing. It's every investment's always had some kind of impact. We're just paying attention to what that is and specifically looking for opportunities that that are linking the financial opportunity to the impact opportunity.
Yeah. And it's great because, you know, it kind of leads me to some of the conversation that's been had is not all impact looks the same for every investor.
No.
So what does impact look like for you in your portfolio?
So also because we're trying to do this across asset classes and with a full portfolio, one thing we did not do when we set out to do this 12 or so years ago was we didn't set one or a couple particular impact targets. Like we didn't say we are going to remove X amount of carbon from the environment, or we are going to educate X number of adolescent girls. We did not do that across the portfolio because I don't know how to be honest about getting to one of those targets with a portfolio that encompasses everything from private real estate to hedge funds. It feels dishonest to say that those things should be trying to achieve the same targets.
Yeah.
So what we decided to do was really start with the asset allocation. And then we take impact at the fund manager level. And so what is this fund trying to do? What's the problem it's trying to solve? And what are the targets that are appropriate for that fund? And so impact looks really different in different ways. So in our private debt portfolio, for example, with one manager, it might be how many small businesses run by veterans and people of color in the middle of the United States have they served? Whereas for an activist-style public equity manager, it might be, you know, how many resolutions or board seats did they influence?
Yeah.
And those are just super different things. And I guess, I mean, I'm excited about investment and financial diversification. I am also totally cool with impact diversification.
Yeah. And over those different asset classes, is that emerging where you start to see some commonality? So like in the hedge fund space, these are typically the parameters you want to engage with. And I don't mean, as you say, you know, amount of carbon saved, but more when you engage with a manager in the hedge fund space, just because of the nature of the way the cash is returned or the redemptions work, you know, you want to be able to think about impact in a certain way. Or with a private equity, they have more control, more decision making, right? So are there certain asset classes that you started to determine the way you want to engage with managers and things that you're looking for in terms of how you determine what's more impactful? Or so, is that something that's evolving?
So I would say, right, okay. So I think there's a line of thinking, right, that is like the closer you are to the deal, the more investor contribution you have, right? So if I found, you know, this founder when they were in idea stage and I funded them, I am directly related to the impact of that company, as opposed to I'm trading paper, you know, in an ESG ETF. Yeah. And I totally understand that argument. However, I think when you sort of add scale to that, then things change a little bit. So one of the things that we have found is we think there's a place for all asset classes in the impact space. And I think just because a company goes public doesn't mean that it should be sort of shunned by the impact community. Although I know there are lots of impact investors who are like, oh, public markets, I'm so sick of it. Like, because I feel like I can't have any influence, too many competing incentives, things like that. But luckily, I think there are a lot of people who say, actually, public markets are it. That's where the impact should be, and there's not enough attention what's happening there. So I'm sort of polyamorous when it comes to asset classes. But what I have seen, though, even though we were sort of impact or sector agnostic when we were building our portfolio, what I have seen is certain sectors sort of have organically emerged. So if I look at our portfolio, the majority of our investments have sort of clumped into two sectors, financial services and sort of climate clean energy, I would say, are the two areas that have kind of thematically take over most of the pie chart when I look at it.
Yeah.
And that was not on purpose. That was not a sort of strategic investment decision. That emerged opportunistically from where we saw kind of most opportunities that were in that bullseye of the impact is being generated from the financial opportunity.
Yeah.
And then when we sort of started to notice that, we were like, actually, that makes sense. Like, these are two sectors, financial services and energy, that actually markets are pretty good at serving, right? They're pretty good at innovating. They're pretty good at getting scale. They're pretty good at adapting, like, and people will pay for those services. And so we noticed that, you know, although we do have a few ed tech funds, for example, in our portfolio, and we love what they're doing, it's a teeny tiny percentage of the overall investment portfolio, because I believe as a sector, education typically doesn't have a risk-adjusted return. There are bits and pieces in there, and there are some incredible companies and incredible funds that are finding them. But generally speaking, most people do not want to pay what education is worth. And so it's not a great fit for a risk-adjusted investment portfolio writ large.
Yes.
So we've started to see patterns like that, and they make sense to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen that on a venture fund that I'm on, and for the ed techs, either CapEx heavy or they're market-based place services, and they're already cash flow positive. And then so as a result, you know, you're getting a lot more cash leaning into those. So it's interesting. But yes, I conceptually agree, having from what I've seen as well, the education sector.
Well, and that's the thing is, again, I want to be super clear. Like, there are some incredible, incredible models and companies that are coming in and trying to address that space.
Yeah.
And that's why we have searched for those kinds of funds and invested in them. And I'm really excited about what they're doing. But just from a trend, sort of broad scale sector standpoint, as an impact investor, I'm not surprised, taking an opportunistic approach, that we've ended up with a smaller percentage.
Yeah. And how about region as well? Has that, because obviously it sounds like the way you're constructing your portfolio is opportunistic, as what, though, although it's positive impact intentional. How have you found that composition start to look regionally as well for you?
So one thing that is less opportunistic In our portfolio that we decided to do was in 2014. We took a portion of our private equity portfolio and brought it in-house and sort of created our own evergreen direct investing fund. So that's almost 10 years old now, which is kind of crazy. But we sort of carved out, so it's a $50 million evergreen fund that looks at early stage fintech and then logistics businesses as well in sub-Saharan Africa. And that sort of spun out of, before I kind of established our family office, I was working at a microfinance organization and then worked for a foundation that did lending to low-fee private schools in sub-Saharan Africa. And so I was sort of there when M-Pesa came online and sort of started watching digital financial services start to take off. And so that portfolio's thesis is around, here is a large, growing, young, digitally savvy, and hungry population that is severely underbanked. And so we think the coolest and most interesting and most necessary fintech business models are actually going to come out of, I mean, in our case, sub-Saharan Africa. We've also expanded into India as well. But these are the markets that are really going to lead that revolution. And the other thing that we found as well is that these are also markets that, you know, if you're sitting at McKinsey doing desk research, it seems like, you know, oh, a company in Kenya should easily be able to expand to Ethiopia, should easily be able, you're laughing, exactly. And so we think these businesses are actually an acquisition story as opposed to being blitzkrieged by somebody coming in. Yeah. And we've seen that with some of our portfolio companies as well, like Paystack that got bought by Stripe, as opposed to getting kind of blitzkrieged by a multinational from abroad. So that's the play there, which is, yes, more strategic. But I would say that's, you know, that our emerging markets focus, yes, heavily in kind of fintech financial services through sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia. But other than that, I mean, if we're looking at the whole broad portfolio, it's pretty global. But we're, if you look at us, you would say, yes, that's a U.S. investor.
So let's talk about philanthropic capital and the word, the term catalytic capital. Right. And also particularly as, you know, what I've liked and read and heard is your philanthropic capital intention supports your portfolio, which is really interesting because, you know, we hear about it either separate, you know, there's a foundation side, a for-profit side, the for-profit side make money and then you go to philanthropy side, or philanthropy side has very specific niches about what it does, but it may not necessarily look at what the for-profit's doing. Blue Haven seems to have a different take on that, and I'd love to, yeah, for you to share that story. And
sure. So one of the things that we try to do at the family office level is really try to think synergistically and sort of from a system standpoint about what we're doing. And investment capital markets are wonderful at the things they are wonderful at, but let's be honest, they're not good at everything and they don't solve every problem. And they come in when incentives are correct and aligned. And so what do you do when incentives aren't there, or you have things that are great ideas, but they are genuinely not risk adjusted? And you couldn't justify that in a portfolio that is aiming to have risk-adjusted returns, but you still really like what they're doing. And so that's where we use our philanthropic capital, is sort of to say, okay, here's a situation. Maybe the market's not ready. Maybe this could be market rate one day, but it isn't today because there's too much risk. Either it's perceived or it's genuine or it's technology risk or it's a science experiment or there's policy risk or people just aren't sure. And so, but maybe in 5 years they'll be sure.
Yeah.
But let's use our riskiest capital, which is our philanthropic capital, to test that out and see if it's okay, but not have it be beholden to the return targets that the rest of the portfolio is.
Yeah, so almost the investor mind in me thinks about it as like a P&L. Like you're almost, you know, testing to see that the revenue demand is there.
Yeah.
Using the capital. Because once you do that, you're understanding the capacity nature of the investment's potential.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so what is, and is this, I mean, one real way to think about, one way I think about catalytic capital in my definition versus concessionary is both of these things are subsidized in some way because they're not risk-adjusted returns. But is this, what is the nature of the subsidy? Is it perpetual? Is it an intrinsic, it's forever going to need to be subsidized? Nobody is ever going to pay the true value of kindergarten, for example, for a five-year-old.
Yeah.
No, it's return on the investment is so great, but nobody will ever pay it.
There's that, and there's like the first loss concept as well, where you know, as an investor, you're sort of sitting in line saying, "Well, you'll take the first, you know, you'll be the first."
Well, right. Well, right. And so is that, but is the subsidy perpetual or is it transitory? Is this, this girl's first fund is not going to be a risk-adjusted return, but a third fund is. Yeah. Her third fund is totally going to be amazing if she makes it to fund three.
Yeah.
And so that's one way we think about catalytic as well, is that is this, let's be honest, it's too risky right now, but if it works, it won't be.
Yeah.
And so it's a transitory risk, a transitory subsidy as opposed to perpetual.
I love the way you describe that as well, because the market around catalytic, it's emerging.
Oh, it's very confusing.
And yes, exactly. It says it catalytic, concessionary, first loss, you know, and then this transitory is quite an interesting concept to bring into play.
And so that's how we think of catalytic capital at Blue Haven. And those are the kinds of things that we're looking for. So if we're like, this is super cool, it would never pass the IC on for the broader portfolio, but we really like it. So, okay, let's look at it now through this other lens and a different framework that we have. But then we also have just straight grant capital that, you know, where we give grants to things that we're really not expecting any kind of market whatsoever, but we think is incredibly important. And that's our kind of civic engagement and democracy building philanthropic work that my husband heads up. But
can you share one of those examples? And I think in particular, you were talking about youth engagement in the US and how that led. I don't want to spoil the story. I'll let you tell the story.
Well, So in case you don't know what's going on in the US at the moment, things have gone south. Since the sort of glorious, you know, heady Obama days where we thought racism is over, young people turn out in droves to vote, democracy is here forever, and, you know, the arc of history has been bent deeply towards justice. Everything is great and wonderful. Things have shifted.
It's not like that over the pond.
I know, exactly right. It's like the whole, and so, but one of these things, so actually I give credit where credit is due to my husband, who's been working on this for decades. And when we met, so we met in 2010, and, you know, we were talking about what, you know, what is he interested in? What am I interested in? He said, you know, I really focus on democracy building. And I was like, what? Like, this is America in 2010. What are you talking about? Like, I don't even know what that means. That's not a thing. That doesn't sound very useful. I'm doing business for good. Like, it was just a really, a very naive conversation. And then, you know, everybody did what I did and took that for granted, right? This idea that you don't have to work on democracy. This isn't to talk about perpetual, you know, things that of a perpetual nature, you really have to actively work on building coalitions, having people understand how important that is to have a free and fair society, and not to take it for granted and to get engaged. And so he had been working on getting young people to vote in particular for a very long time. And he started a program in the U.S. that measures voting on college campuses, which had never been done before, and then gives those colleges a plan for how to register and then increase voter turnout on their campuses. And it's been incredibly successful, and thousands of campuses have signed up for it. And you also learn things like, you know, the students at Bay State Community College vote much more regularly than the kids at Harvard. And so maybe senators should make a pit stop at Bay State Community College instead of only at Harvard. So there's some things like that that have turned up that are interesting. But one of the things that has really humbled me in watching him and his work is, a few, maybe a year or two ago, I was asked to give a presentation on Blue Haven's climate portfolio. And so gathering all of our climate investments across asset classes, including grants we've given to accelerators and different research institutes and our catalytic capital portfolio. So I was kind of really looking at like the whole gamut of stuff Blue Haven currently has outstanding in our climate portfolio. And I was like, oh, wow, it's like $125 million. Wow, this is really cool. I'm going through some examples. And then somebody asked me, which of these investments has the best ROI from a climate standpoint? What's really kind of moved the needle? And I was looking at it and I was like, oh, it's not on here. It's actually Ian's youth voter engagement work. So young people turning out to vote in 2020 and in 2022 sent a very clear message to our Congress in the U.S. that climate is an incredibly important agenda item for them. And but for that pressure, they themselves have said to Ian that the Inflation Reduction Act, which just is full of carrots for climate investing and infrastructure and transition, would not have passed without the pressure from young voters and knowing that they would not turn out in 2024 if they did not put something on the table that was serious and real in terms of climate. And so, again, I'm very excited about the climate investments in our investment portfolio, but when it's coupled with this engagement work and the activism work, I think then it really kind of makes
it accelerates it, and the capacity building, you know,
and
starts
we need
to create
all
that
of those things. We need all of those things, and so no one investment is going to move the needle, and no one election is going to move the needle. But I think what we're trying to do is have a really honest view at Blue Haven that we really have to engage with our political voice as well as our investment capital, and push hard in both directions in order for this to happen.
Well, my investor mind and brain recognizes $400 billion on civic engagement work is a pretty good return.
Yeah, well, I mean, right, exactly. And so, and not that, I mean, you know, a lot of people were involved with that, but yeah, for pound for pound, like that was a really good ROI.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. So let's talk about, you know, some of the key insights you've had on some of the work that you've done, both in Blue Haven, but also, you know, you are on board of other impact investing organizations and trying to promote and advance that field as well. And so, you know, what is, you know, part of that, I guess, that journey, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're seeing a lot of emerging managers in that as well. And so what's your advice to those starting off on their impact investing journey, whether they be an emerging manager or they're a family office trying to support emerging managers? And what advice do they give to their CIOs?
I mean, I guess starting with emerging managers, I would say this is definitely a better time to be launching a fund. I mean, particularly, I think this vintage year hopefully is going to be particularly good, just to be very specific. But there are more investors of different sorts who care about and speak this language. And so, you know, even just five years ago, certainly 10 years ago, there were like a handful of LPs that you would go to in order to get capital into your fund. And now there are other sources of it, and also particularly people saying, we need to support emerging managers. We are looking for first-time managers and accelerators for them. And so I think looking at, you know, there's things like Capria abroad, there's VC Include in the US, there's you know, several other kind of fund accelerators. So I'd say looking at some of those for resources. And LPs are often hovering around them looking for who's coming out of those and who's exciting. I think that for family offices, also, there are really great resources. There's things like the Impact or Tonic, which are great, or Nexus, that are impact investing networks where you can meet other people. I personally find that the best way to learn is by sitting next to another investor and kind of talking about our portfolio and going through and seeing what others have found and what do they think about this. And you know, because you can't be an expert in everything. And so relying on peers that have sector expertise in gender lens investing or in a certain geography. And so when something comes across your desk, you've got a network that you can say, hey,
what
do you think of this? Is this bullshit? Or like, what do you think?
Yeah.
And so, you know, recently this happened for a fund that I sit on the IC for, an investment in a Brazilian reforestation fund came across the desk, and you know, and all, everything kind of looked good, seemed fine, and then pinged members of the Impact, who are Brazilian families, who this is like, they are experts.
This is their jam. Yeah,
exactly. And holy smokes, like the comments and the questions and the nuance and all of that was just so much more. And so I think, you know, being able to phone a friend,
build your network.
I think is just the best way to do it, both for principals as well as for executives and CIOs.
Yeah.
Because there are resources for them too. There's sort of an age-old thing in the impact investing family office world of the principal really wants to do it, but the sort of lawyer CIO who's been with the family for 30 years doesn't want to do it, and the kid has no credibility, and there's like this back and forth. But I think that there are peer groups now that are emerging. So the CIO can talk to another CIO directly who's done this and thinks it isn't crazy.
Yeah. And just broader for the field of impact investing, because you've obviously, you know, you've been in it for a long time and you've advanced that field as well. Where do you think the cycle of the field of impact investing is at? And what do you think are some of the positives you've seen? And what do you think some of the challenges of the industry are?
Well, I mean, not that impact and ESG are the same, and I don't really want to open up that can of worms at this point.
Exactly.
Not saying that they are the same. However, the fact that there is a backlash on ESG, it's like, oh my God, they know who we are. Like, what? That's crazy. We must be enough of a thing in order for there to be a backlash. So that's kind of cool. Just to start out, that's a whole other thing. But anyway, I think that at least says the ball's rolling down the hill. This is something people have heard of and are aware of. Corporates know what it is. There isn't a single large bank that doesn't know what this is and doesn't at least have some type of, you know, marketing piece of work that says that they're leaders in it. So there's that. And with all that comes all the greenwashing and all of that. But I'm not worried about that. I mean, all investing is filled with, you know, buyer beware. Like, so yeah. I think this is nothing new. You know, and if everybody sees a trend that's going to be a mega trend and then they want to jump on. And so there's going to be a lot of lemons in there. So buyer beware. But that doesn't really worry me. I think the part that, and this will come as no surprise given my previous comments, but I think that investors who are afraid to get a little bit political or to, you know,
choose a stance.
Yeah, because the thing is that you can have a company that sort of their core business might be in something that's exciting from a climate standpoint. And then, I mean, in the U.S., this is a particular issue. And then all they're doing is, you know, funding senators and congressmen who want to, you know, ban trans people. Like, there's just a lot of hypocrisy within these corporate entities. And I think that we need to be straightforward about that. And companies, we need to hold companies accountable for their own hypocritical stances. You can't get ESG points over here and then also be backing, you know, senators and congressmen who are voting for things that are against those principles that you've told your staff you're for, just because the government relations department is very opaque. So I think the hypocrisy, that I worry about within corporates. And there, again, it's tough as an investor to get right in there. But even with financial advisors, so we work with a team at Goldman Sachs, and I'm really, I love the impact investing team we're working with. They're totally awesome and amazing. And then I say, hey, so what's Goldman Sachs doing in its government relations department? And then blank stares and, you know.
Yeah. So Ian's definitely had an influence.
Yeah, exactly.
So a final question. So in line with the theory of change that we created at the beginning of this series, one thing I've asked all my guests as well is, what is the vision of the world you're seeking to live in and also to leave behind?
I mean, I think it all comes down to accountability. And so I want to live in a world where I get credit for the things I did right and also take responsibility and clean up the messes I made. And I should do that. That shouldn't be left to my kids. It shouldn't be left to somebody else that I pay. That should be something each and every one of us does. Clean up your own goddamn mess. And just starting there, I think, would be a really great place. And I think think of all the extra time share, mind share we would have if we didn't have messes to clean up and we were only innovating and having fun.
Love that. Clean up your mess, everyone. Thank you so much, Liesl.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Humanizing Investment with The Conduit. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please do subscribe. To learn more about Liesl and her work, please go to the Blue Haven Initiative website, www.bluehaveninitiative.com. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.